podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Nicely along from Hall to John Dawes. This is Bevan, inside steal, beautifully tackled by Ray. Kicked on by John Taylor, hooded on by Barry John. Can John make it? This would be a remarkable score.
Welcome to another Six Nations special episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. And what an opening weekend it was. Absolutely bizarre, berserk, absurd rugby on offer. And yeah, none more so than in Cardiff on Saturday, where Wales very nearly pulled back the most absurd of all comebacks. So as you can imagine, we're going to be diving into that. But unfortunately, it's sad news that we've got to start with. As you'll have heard, Barry John has died, and that's naturally the place where we're going to start. I'm joined by Yestin George to talk through all of this. Hi, Yes, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you, Jared.
Yeah, well, as I say, we'll start with Barry John. I mean, it is hard to get too hyperbolic about the influence that Barry John had on the sport, not just in Wales, but across the whole of the sport, isn't it?
Yeah, you just look back and you just think he scored 120 points and he retired at 27, and you kind of go, oh, all right, you know. Yeah. And the impact that somebody can have in that short period of time, it's sort of testimony to the fact that it isn't really about numbers in the end. It's about seeing people doing things that you've never seen before and people playing in a way that you've never seen them. I don't know about you, because obviously you're considerably younger than me, but Barry John was just predated my sort of regular going to international matches. Mm. And so it's always kind of players who are just before your time are kind of cloaked in a mystery that is obviously heightened by the same old clips time and time and time again, like in sort of Adam Curtis documentary or something. You just see a snatch of the same thing and repeat his little dancing feet. And I just think that also, you know, the other players then are mere mortals. So obviously Phil Bennett is a player who's immortal, you know, who quite rightly deserves the accolade of one of the true greats. But when you've seen them play maybe a game that they weren't completely on song, and you've seen the magic, but you've also seen the kind of the ordinary humanness of the probably Barry John was the last of the players that just about got enough. There are enough visuals and enough
mystique as well.
Yeah, it's just enough. Whereas after he retired, I guess there was more rugby on television, and so people can remember these times. You don't see ASPM sticking sort of clips of Barry John playing, you know, on a muddy field somewhere with David Perry Jones commentating.
Yeah,
that just doesn't happen. So there's a magic that as well. I'm always fascinated by these figures that you don't actually know. You don't know what they were like apart from what you saw and what other people say about them.
And I think it's what the other people say that makes it so amazing. Like you say, there's so much, you know, we live in an age now where every game of rugby is, you know, is televised or streamed in some way or another. So if you want to go and, you know, and relive, you know, the Netherlands nearly win. Yes. Yeah, so, you know, you can do that. All of that is available. But as you say, in Barry John's era, you've got the folklore that goes with it, which in a way does overly romanticize it. But also, it's I think the thing that sticks in the mind is the opinion of of the New Zealand rugby fans as well, who, you know, and the press, you know, who spoke about that performance in 71, or those series of performances, and how commanding he was. And, you know, there's no one more sceptical or cynical than, you know, during a Lions tour than fans and journalists of New Zealand, and completely won them over with, you know, with such a dominant display. And I think that's the thing, you know, those are those stories that live on and had that real impact. But also, I think you're right, there is something about retiring at 27 as well, at the peak of, you know, at the peak of his powers and shocking everyone, and versus the, you know, I guess, you know, Benny, and I'm not comparing, you know, there's no need to compare the two because they're both, you know, of godlike status. But Benny had to endure kind of tougher times at the end and captaining the Lions and in really difficult circumstances back in New Zealand and all those things that don't, you know, in no way take away from what an incredible player he was. But I guess it's not as easy to create that immortal figure when you, you know, or it's easier to do it if you haven't been through that rough patch, I guess.
With Bennett, and I know this is about Barry John, with Bennett, yeah, he had that opportunity as well then towards the end of his career to play club rugby like a god. He was untouchable towards the end of his career. It was almost like he'd regained all his powers that he had in his younger days. And I suppose we always just think what would have happened, what if Barry John had carried on, etc., etc. But so every outside half in my youth, as a child and as a teenager, it was always Barry John. It wasn't because Bennett was there, and you know, and a host of other great players. You could see them; they were flesh and blood. And Barry John never felt like flesh and blood. And so when we were gnashing our teeth with frustration, perhaps, it was always Barry, where's our Barry John? Where's our, and without sort of being too glib about it, the closest thing I've seen was Jonathan Davis. You know, Jiffy was that sort of mercurial talent that seemed to transcend the sport in just in the way that he and the attitude he played. But what I love about, the thing about Barry John was it is about the magic. It's not about the numbers. It's not about the tries. Yes, okay, of course, 1971 and the Lions victory in New Zealand is the thing that crowns the story. But it really was the way that he glided, the way that he held the ball in two hands, the fact that he was so slight and elegant, and I'm not sure he had much of a kicking game, but obviously not by modern standards. You know, he would have struggled to, you know, but it was about the magic of a running rugby player who just seemed to be able to make the players around him play brilliantly as well as being a real mercurial individual talent. And I guess to a certain extent, those kind of players are usually seen as not selfish, but almost, you know, when you think about players like in football, like Glenn Hoddle or somebody like that, they were too good for the rest of the team. But I don't think that was Barry John. He seemed to, you know, make the most of what was around him as well. So,
but that team as well was just, you know, was littered with stars and, you know, and legends. And that's the thing, is, you know, to be able to stand out in a side like that is testament to just how much he captured the imagination. I think you're right. It's, again, obviously, I've never seen him play. My knowledge of Barry John is like many people of my age and a bit older is watching The Crown in years, VHS on repeat, and you know, and it is stuff like that, because it's incredible to just remember a time when Wales dominated the world, you know, and it's he was so central to that. So yeah, you know, obviously there's a degree of romance about it, but that's the beauty, right? Because it is,
yeah,
you know, like you said, it's not about,
don't deny the romance. The romance, yeah, no, is all we've got. This is the theme of the weekend, right? The romance is what it's all about.
All right. Well, let's move it on to the weekend then, and let's debate romance versus pragmatism, because you've had some great listeners' questions in, so I'm going to pepper them throughout the episode. This one is from Gary Mason. Is focusing on our second half 25-minute spell a wild goose chase? Is it realistic for Wales to play like that from the start of a game? What do you reckon, Jess?
I don't think it is. What yesterday served to prove, if anything, is that rugby is almost a systemic game, and I admire those who play it the best, and everybody admires it. But this certain set of circumstances that made yesterday's second half happen weren't tactical, they weren't selectorial. They were partly all these things, but they weren't all to do with, or they weren't to do with, a motivational hiding at halftime, perhaps. I don't know what went on there.
Well, judging by the third try that Scotland scored within minutes of the second half beginning, perhaps it wasn't the motivational masterclass at halftime.
It is. It's about the thing that we love. It's the thing that you can't put your finger on. It's the magic and the circumstance and the heart and. I've never been in the stadium before when fans have been laughing before half time because when another overthrow goes awry at an attacking line out, it had got to the stage where it was a late kickoff, right? And we all know late kickoffs tend to be, it's quite hard to stimulate the crowd have already been stimulated to the max, and sometimes they get a bit sleepy and a bit dozy, and sometimes they get a bit disillusioned quite quickly. This was the people were laughing, and not with a kind of, it felt like that thing that you hate about going to these games, which is people are just having a day out, and it's, you know, with Josh Navidi playing DJing at halftime, you know, and everybody's just it's like going to Spoons, really. But with, you know, if Spoons put a mini rugby pitch in, it wouldn't be very much different, or Prism. It's a very laboured answer, I'm sorry, but my feeling is that it wouldn't have made a difference, because I think a unique set of circumstances in rugby is what we love, and what happened yesterday I don't think you could replicate the set of circumstances or the heart and the soul. I'm not saying that they haven't got heart and soul, because they clearly have. I mean, nobody is turning up there not wanting to do their best.
Yeah.
And also, it would be so easy for somebody like me, who's just an absolute, you know, pain in the neck idealist, sort of to say, oh, well, you see, if you get systems obsessed, then you don't play what's in front of you. But it wasn't that either, you know. It was a whole load of different things, and it was just great to see. And I, you know, perversely thought everybody left, you know, just pleased that the team and that a bunch of people who were representing Wales probably did their very best and their utmost to pull it off and showed a ton of heart.
Yeah, and that's that. I'm gonna perhaps pour a little bit of cold water on the romance for a bit for reigniting it towards the end of this, because I mean, look, the first half was so awful, and to get back to the kind of what went right in the second half and things like that is actually a lot of the nuts and bolts did just go right. You know, Elliot D came on and made a massive difference with his darts, and most of those tries were scored off driving lineouts or consistent pressure. And I hate to do this on today of all days, but it was a question of the first half. We didn't win the collisions. We couldn't tackle. Our carries were hopeless. we kicked really poorly. It was a modern thing. And we got those things right in the second half. So, yes, there was that brilliant bust from Wayne Wright and Rio Dyer flying down the wing and that Tompkins offload to Thomas Williams for the missed pass. You know, all those lovely things as well. But ultimately, I think what got us the points and got us back in the game was we managed to have a driving line out and we managed to make some tackles and play test match level rugby. But the thing that is encouraging and heartening and the romantic bit is this is a really young set of players, and that could have been an absolute dicking of the highest order. And to find that spirit and dig in, that's something that, you know, that you can actually cling on to and go, you have every right to feel proud, even though you've lost that game by a point. And it's really frustrating because we should have won it. You know, we should have won it. And I know Gatland has seemingly kind of thrown Josh Adams under the bus a bit by kind of publicly saying, and it was a soft penalty. He will know that. I perhaps wonder, without blindly defending Gatland, we know that he knows generally how to push players' buttons, you know, and I imagine Josh Adams is the kind of player who will respond from that. I reckon he'll get picked again next week and will come back a better version of himself because, you know, I think he is that really driven character who responds to adversity. You know, he's let go by the Scarlets at the start of his career and rebuilt and worked really hard, became a Test Lion, etc. I'd rather Gatland didn't do it in public. I think it's not a modern look, is it? But nonetheless, I think, yeah, there is something within that side that I hope that they can build on. And we saw it during the World Cup, admittedly with a lot more experience around them, but there is, you know, there can be a real sense of belief in them. So I don't think that 25-minute spell is a wild goose chase, but I also don't think you can ever play as badly as we did in that first half, even for a 10-minute spell of a test match and hope to win it. You know, I think it's, it has got to be. I hope that there really is something to build on and, you know, and what a game next week to go into to try and build and get something out of.
It was interesting. I'll counter your cold water with some extra hot water. I don't know how this works. Everything's just going to turn tepid, isn't it? Because I don't think, right, had Wainwright not busted, had winning not been that, we've all been, you know, in like, you know, the local Tiddlywinks Championship sort of thing. You know, we've had a kind of boost to our confidence, and then we're going. And we also know that over-adrenalized rugby players have a tendency to throw the ball over the back of the lineup and straight into the hands of the inside centre of the opposite team. But I genuinely think I agree with you completely on everything you say. But I think that the added sort of element is that one broken tackle, that one pass that goes to hand, that one and obviously good decision making and smart decision making. You know, it's emphasized by that, the fact that, as Jiffy was crying out, that I could see it in the pitch that they, when it wasn't going to the line before kicking and wasn't we were losing the kicking battle. It was just from literally the first kick, you said, you know, you could see we were done from when you were in the stadium. It we had no menace or threat at all in that game, but we did repeat ourselves, and we did repeat it almost and into the second half. And where when it should have been 10 yards further up the field before releasing the ball, and clearly they made a decision, I think, after that to. And it was really interesting what Finn Russell said afterwards, because he threw his players under.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And I thought
a really interesting post-match captain speech.
I know. I loved it because obviously, you know, we like a bit of honesty and a bit of openness. And you know, the last thing we want is another, the boys did great and we got a lot of learning to, and when we review it on Monday. But he said the coaches were instructing them, the players were being instructed from the skipper, and they ignored the advice. They kept on committing to the ruck and they kept on committing offences. So, you know, as we know, there's nothing worse than for bad decision making than being under pressure. And that part of that pressure came from the physicality of the Welsh, and part of that physicality came from something that we've all been, even on a rugby pitch in school, we've seen a player just decide that they won't take it anymore and they're going to just make a difference. And I think making a difference rather than you can't bottle it really. So, but it's a combination of the two things. It's a renewed accuracy matched with a sense that they're not going to allow this to happen, you know.
Yeah, I think just while we bring the first part of the show to a conclusion, a couple of players that I mentioned there who I thought were absolutely yes. So, I mean, Wainwright was brilliant and, you know, quite rightly, you know, man of the match in a losing cause is a really rare thing. And
yeah, and also it's worth mentioning, can you throw the ball to a player more in a lineout? And extraordinarily predictable tactics that Wainwright had to work so hard to win the ball that he won in the lineout. Remarkable, on top of everything else that he was doing.
Yeah, yeah, it was a. I mean, one of those, I'm trying to think, you know, though over the last 10, 15 years, but those standout individual performances, you know, I think like Lou Charteris against Ireland, I remember as being just one of those absolutely, you know, superhuman efforts. This was in that same bracket. It's just, you know, an ability to keep digging and keep performing. And he was absolutely awesome. But I think, you know, and again, I mentioned, you know, I thought Rio Dyer grew in confidence. Elliot D had a big impact off the bench. Most of the bench did. Thomas Williams is playing the rugby of his life. And, you know, we'll come on to selection at the end. But yes, you know, a loose kick for the first try. But after that, he terrified them. He absolutely terrified them. And that was a brilliant thing to watch. But the one player I think, you know, who outside of those who deserves a huge amount of credit is Tommy Reffel. So just, you know, kept, I think it was him and Wainwright were probably the only players in the first half who came out of it, you know, with any positive credit really. And to just keep Wales in the game by being an absolute terrier at the breakdown and tackling, and just isn't that, you know, like, there is an animal instinct about him. And I just, he's an exceptionally brilliant player, and we're very, very lucky to have lots of talented open sides in Wales. And, you know, he probably wouldn't be playing there if Jack Morgan was fit, but yeah, he's exceptional. And that was another massive performance, and it just keeps coming. And if we're going to get anything out of this Six Nations, you need him and these players to keep backing them up, really.
And it's again that unique set of circumstances that was the game at that point that needed somebody like Tommy Reffel. And I can remember turning round to like the whole, I sit in front of a box, which is usually full of absolute twats, and people who are just talking about their loft extensions for 80 minutes. It's tedious beyond belief. And yesterday was full of people from Swansea, obviously. So they were great, you know, obviously. No, they were really lovely. Everybody, when Reffel won one of the breakdowns, everybody just got on their feet and were just screaming his name. It was so exciting. And he, you know, he's got that sort of like slightly mad look in his eyes.
Oh, the eyes. Eyes.
If I saw him...
You saw Tommy in a pub and you call eye contact with him, and, oh, shit, he's seen me. The pub nutter has seen me.
He reminds me of the look in the eyes of somebody I saw in a pub in Newport in Pembrokeshire at a wake at about 2 o'clock in the morning, having just come back from the Gulf War. And he wanted to fight my friend, Paul, and he was kind of determined. And Paul was not really that interested because we were at somebody else's wake, and he was determined. And that's the first time yesterday I thought, I went straight back to the Llwyn Gwair in Newport, Pembrokeshire for a second yesterday.
Yeah, and again, that's probably the kind of analysis that you get on most rugby podcasts. That's the testament of what you want from an open side flanker, and it is for me. I'm 100% in on that wild look in Tommy Reffel's eyes. Love him. Right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got loads more to look at, and we will at the end of the show take a look at the other games from this weekend as well, and all that's coming after this quick break. Right, Right then, time for a few more questions. Yes, then let's take a look at this one from Davey, who says, Costello doesn't look ready to return to Test rugby, having played very little since the Rugby World Cup. Is it time to look at other options off the bench? Lloyd will probably start, but I don't think Evans is the answer either. It's such a crucial position and one that we have very few options for. Yeah, I think we're absolutely right. We don't have a huge amount of options here, particularly with Bigger and Anscombe going at the same time. What are your thoughts on what Wales should do next for the game at Twickenham?
Well, again, with my romantic hat on, at a jaunty angle, I've always had a thought that Johan Lloyd had sort of potential, all-round potential as either a 15 or a 10, to be perfectly honest. They kept on saying he's another fresh-faced one off the bench. He's not very fresh-faced, is he? Let's face it. He looks like a kind of an old 22-year-old.
Doesn't he?
He looks like he's seen a few things in his time. Listen, they must see something in Kai Evans that we haven't seen. And I think it's not just dependability and it's not just he's got a big boot. Surely there's got to be some, I guess, a sort of measured, dispassionate way of playing that people think he's calm under pressure and things like that. I wouldn't be happy to see him on the bench at 10 for Twickenham. And I think you can't say, you know, this is a classic. This is like watching Slammed, the last series of Slammed all over again. You can't just put another in, can you? And you can't, you know, much as I laughed my head off at the time, because even though Gareth Davis is a lovely, lovely man, I loathed him as a player. I think you can't just say Project Costello's over and done with, and he needs to spend some time back in the regions, because that's the last thing he needs. You know, and obviously there are no regional games anyway. So I just think you put Costello on the bench and you start with Lloyd and see how it goes.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, it's hard to know. And he had a dog rough game, Sam Costello. But it's hard to know whether that was the circumstance. I saw a really good tweet which said, for some reason, we asked Sam Costello to play like Rob Andrew for 40 minutes. And it was like that. He stood so deep and kicking. And it was just... it looked very much like it was under orders, and he's got a good kicking game, but you know, there's a lot more to his game than that. He can get the backs outside him going. I mean, I love Johan Lloyd, and watching him this season has been one of the few things that Scarlets fans can get excited about, because he's such a brilliant broken field runner and his first instinct is to go and attack. And I do love that. So from a personal perspective, I'd love to see Johan Lloyd start. If Costello passes, HIA protocol and stuff, which I haven't read about, I'm guessing he probably will. I'd definitely have him in the squad. It's just whether or not, yeah, you go for, you kind of back him and give him that, you know, like in cricket where you back your opener through the series to find a run of form. And they clearly rate him, and I get that completely. As for Kai Evans, he's not played any rugby at 10 this year, and certainly not much rugby at 10 this year. He's been deployed largely as a fullback. And you know, I think there are more exciting options at fullback. I don't know whether he'll be in there for the long term as kind of a 10 cover, or you know, it will be 15 that he's more likely to get a look at. But yeah, again, you know, clearly they obviously rate him to a certain degree. But yeah, I don't know. I think again, you've just got to, for this particular game, I don't think it would be throwing Sam Costello under the bus to put him on the bench, given that I think Lloyd will just get a bit more out of that back line and be more of a threat to an England side that's in transition as well. And that's the thing. I think you can either think defensive, or you can say, right, what would that England coaching setup like to see? Would they like to see Costello in there, or would they like to see Lloyd? And I think they prefer to see Costello in there, given that he's had a bad game, and Lloyd, I think, just plays that bit more fearlessly. And in a side that's, you know, in an England side that's just starting to get to know each other, there will be opportunities to run at them and find chinks in the armour. And yeah, so for me, I'd go for it. Let's go attacking and get him in there.
Yeah, if you were like an Ospreys fan and it was your birthday party and you wanted to have a kind of Dan Bigger lookalike turning up at your party, and if Sam Costello turned up, you'd be a bit disappointed. So you're right, that was just the wrong call for the wrong player, wasn't it, really? And this is where we bang on about the idea of players having to fit into a clearly defined pattern of play. We have applauded Gatland, rightly so, for years and years for playing to our strengths. And I think that,
let's build on that, because I've had another good question in. This one was from Lost in Yorkshire. And it says, is Gatland the right coach for Wales at this time? I am a fan, but should we stick with him? It's clear that the players that we have need to play to a quicker tempo, which is, you know, not historically the Gatland style of play.
It's a good question, but I think, again, I just don't want to chuck the baby out with the bathwater, and it's a commitment, and there are certain things that he does better than most coaches in the world, and there are certain things that we've always thought that perhaps he's you know, we've criticized him for being overly conservative at times, and I just think he's there now. We've got, you know, he's got a good coaching team around him. He's clearly got, you know, we were weeping about the departure of Sean Edwards, but you know, even in the first half, I know we made some crushing, terrible errors, but that you couldn't, you know, there were, I still think that the defensive lineup looks okay. You know, it's not, I've seen fewer embarrassing first half performances, but I've seen worse defensive displays in the first half. That sounds totally contradictory, but I've seen more shambolic defensive,
The thing is, as well, we have had those occasions, particularly at the start of Six Nations under Edwards as well, where, you know, again, I think back to Ireland in 2013, where just we weren't there. And that's probably the closest I've seen to that Scotland before, the performance against Scotland in the first half. That one kind of springs to mind. We have had those first games where we are just not there at the races. And yeah, defensively, yeah, it was all over the shop. But again, the digging in, particularly in the second half, just to keep you in the game, knowing that you couldn't afford to concede any more points in the game. And even right at the end, you know, as I know it was ultimately futile when Van der Merwe was held up over the line. But again, just those bits of, you know, I can't remember, maybe it was Dyer managed to get his leg under the ball. But I think it's those kind of, you know, cute things that are good. But in terms of Gatland being the right coach, I think he's got to embrace the skill set that these players have got. And I do agree. I think it has to be, it can't be, you know, they're not big enough to do that, get the traditional.
No, and he hasn't done what perhaps people might have thought, which is, okay, even the idea of, you know, he sees Mason Griddy turn up on the first day and goes, great, I've got a Jamie Roberts clone coming down the road in a couple of years' time. I don't know whether that's his plan, but I think Gatland, you know, the coaches are now really super aware of the way that the game is evolving, and, you know, these kind of, you've got to get the ball away from the ruck in, you know, 0.5 seconds or whatever, and the presentation of the ball at ruck time is really important to get the ball away, and that obviously, that's where, you know, Gareth Davis was you know, not, it's not all his fault, is it, but he carried the can for that in the first half, and so in short, let's not start undermining the situation by any further, because he's our coach and he's going to do the best that he can. And I would like, if you had somebody waiting in the wings who was just screamingly obvious, that was a Welsh coach who was, you know, leading La Rochelle to sort of European glory, and we're going, why are they not talking to him? Or, you know, then it would be obvious, but I just, there isn't, you know, there isn't a screamingly obvious alternative, is there? I used to bang on about Pat Lamb, didn't I? And that's something that, you know, you haven't heard me sort of saying much about that in the last couple of years.
No. There is an Irishman coach in La Rochelle who I'd be quite interested to have a look at some point down the line, particularly given that I think Ireland, the talk seems to be that when Farrell does move on, that O'Connell will be the front runner and they want to promote and keep that kind of the continuity candidate, if you like. And so, you know, I think would be a very interesting appointment.
And would make for interesting press conferences again as well. So, you know.
Yeah, it would, absolutely, yeah. Anyway, I digress. But yeah, for the time being, I think so. And also particularly at the start of the Six Nations, where there has been something, you know, you'd hope that there is something to build on. I'm hoping it's one of those moments like New Zealand in 2003, where all of a sudden it was, oh, geez, we can do something that other sides in the world won't enjoy. And, you know, admittedly, we didn't win that game or the game against England, but it was the start of something. And that was the seeds for 2005, wasn't it? We're all built there, that style of play.
And it goes back to the idea of Costello or Lloyd. It's, look, we've got what we've got. And, you know, I think the vibe yesterday in the stadium was, you know, if we surrender meekly, then it's just going to be horrible. You know, nobody wants to see any team that they support just going through the motions and taking hiding and then saying, well, you know, we're building, you know, these players are becoming more resilient with every hiding they're getting. It's like that, it doesn't work like that, you know. And eight caps in, and, you know, we may only win one game this year, you know, but in the realistic state of mind, if we only win one game, if we can put three good performances during that period, then you kind of go, well, there's something to build on. But the realistic kind of prognosis is it's not about necessarily about winning right now.
No, I don't think it is. And the real tough test is not.
Yeah, and it's certainly not about playing efficiently to a pattern either, you know, and then just losing by 20 points. It's about players, you know, showing exciting potential for the future.
Yeah, I think like to look at, because the thing is we're reaping the what's been sowed at regional level, right? And if you don't invest particularly well in your club rugby structure, as we've covered a number of times, you end up with difficult circumstances that we've seen the reasons in at the moment. The encouraging thing from there is the crop of young talent, which has been fast-tracked into the Welsh side out of necessity. But if you were to look at the two things that I think are encouraging from regional rugby, it's the heart and the grit and the determination that the Ospreys have showed. And I think that's something, again, that you want to instill into this Welsh side. And I think, you know, some of those players, weirdly, there's not huge chunks of the Ospreys team in there, given that they're the one punching above their weight at the moment. But I think, you know, in players like, to a certain degree, Adam Beard, who seems to be, you know, kind of much maligned and, certainly didn't have his best game yesterday. But those players who are down there, I think you can really bring in that sense of backs against the wall. Let's go and do this, and let's dig in really deep. And just because the odds are stacked against us, you know, we're certainly not going to cave in and let anyone walk all over us. And then the kind of, I guess, the ambition and the encouraging performances that you're seeing at Cardiff, although they're not winning games, they are winning fans, you know, and that is happening. There is clearly a sense down there that you've got a crop of young players who are particularly, you know, local lads. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if this is going to get overly political or make me sound like some kind of UKIP dick, but which I'm certainly not. But like, I don't know, there's something a bit cynical about the Scottish approach to recruitment from my point of view. And they're not doing anything wrong. And I guess you have to. And it's not like we don't have players that are from different, you know, from, yeah, I guess, you know, through on residency as well. But I don't know. I kind of would rather be in our situation where they're all, you know, largely speaking, the squad is made up of players who have come through the Welsh system are homegrown players. That's why I don't want it to get into, you know, some nasty nationalistic debate, because if you move somewhere and you know, I remember speaking to Willis Halaholo about this, and he's very, very passionate about the fact that he's lived in Wales a long time. It's been a really good, you know, it's been a great country for him. His daughters were born there. He's got a huge affinity and affiliation. I just think that that's different than a player who's kind of been plucked out with a very cynical view to live here for a couple of years and then you can pull on the national jersey, which is just, I don't know, it can just dilute the essence of the international game. If you want, this is dangerous territory for me because it's,
yeah, you know, and we've done it, you know, we've done that before, haven't we? We've done it plenty of times before. But the it's also worth pointing out, and you're in a much better position to comment than I am, it's like the Dragons, man. It's like the beaten and bloody Dragons were responsible for a significant portion of the under 20s team that played on Friday night, and obviously there were Dragons in right at the vanguard yesterday afternoon. So
yeah, and there has to be some hope when you look at the under 20s and say, and I don't want to feel like I'm slamming Scotland here, but again, their under 20s has been a struggle for you, and producing homegrown talent has been a struggle for them, which is why they've brought in a lot of kind of foreign imports and stuff. And I think that it's even though that our club sides are not in the greatest nick, the talent is still there, and there must clearly be enough interest in rugby in Wales to be producing these players, even at a region like the Dragons, where you don't, you know, we win one game a season or whatever it is, and it's, you know, but the talent keeps coming through, and you just got to find, a way to make these sides more competitive. I've gone massively off piece here, but I don't know. It's just these crumbs of solace that you cling onto in another batshit mental year of Welsh rugby.
That's what you've got to do. You know, it sounds their job right now is not to go off and promise that they're going to win a Triple Crown or a Grand Slam. Their promise to us is that they're going to entertain us and make us proud on their behalf, you know, make us happy to see them play well. You know, ultimately, it's not about us. It's about us going, what a brilliant thing to see Rio Dyer in full flight. What a great thing to see Corey Domachowski's, like, ludicrous commitment to, you know, to the cause, or, you know, players that you don't have a natural affinity for even, you know, and you just kind of go, you know, where did that come from, and just admire it. You know, you want to see players realize their potential, and it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to win much, but that's all we got to go for at the moment until further notice.
Right, we are going to take one more quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to take a look ahead to that game at Twickenham, which takes place next Saturday. We're also going to have a look at some of the other results and performances from this weekend as well. But first, we're going to take a quick break. Right, looking ahead to next week, do you want to look ahead now, or do you want to quickly talk about Ireland, France? Because again, it was should we do that?
Yeah, go on. Yeah, it was weird because I suppose in the way that we weren't sure whether it was partly Scotland's, you know, Scotland were beating themselves up about being rubbish in the second half rather than saying that we were great. And obviously we focused on the fact that we think that we were great in the second half. Similarly, Ireland were Ireland fantastic? I actually didn't think they were as fantastic as they've been, and that's a very high water. Mm. You know, they fair play. You know, they've absolutely made my jaw drop at times in the last year. But France were just really surprised how they seem to be in disarray at times. And even though they just kind of like shoved they showed they kind of kept within touching distance through grim determination. It didn't really look like they were ever going to really. I suppose there's always a possibility of snatching a win when you're not playing very well, but they weren't playing very well, were they?
No, they weren't. I'm more inclined to say that it was as a result of Ireland piling the pressure on, though. I think if you look at the halfbacks who we know are quality, although you're missing Dupont and Tomac, you still have, two truly class halfbacks in France. And I just thought Ireland put so much pressure on them the whole time. And then, again, nuts and bolts from Ireland, line speed, the carrying was great. Joe McCarthy looked every inch a test match animal. And
nuts, right? That's like unbelievable.
Yeah, and Tadhg Burn as well, who just, again, continues to put in big performances, kind of doesn't matter where he's playing. And, I think that it was just, really ruthless and efficient from Ireland. And that put the pressure on the French. And, and for once they didn't have an answer, which, obviously in the World Cup, they didn't have an answer against South Africa, but it was the test match rugby of the highest level. Whereas actually this one, Ireland were playing at top level and France couldn't cope and ran out of puff, which was unexpected. But it's going to be hard to stop Ireland from here, isn't it? I predicted France to win it, and obviously they didn't do it. But I just think those two teams are in another league compared to the other four sides in the tournament. So from here on in, Ireland have got every chance of going and slamming again, haven't they?
Yeah, totally. That would be a shock, wouldn't it? If it wasn't, what are the odds? You're a betting man.
I'm a betting man. I don't know now, actually, but yeah, I don't think you get a huge amount of value in it. And I think it's just because they are that good. I mean, the brilliant and the beauty of the Six Nations is that you do just never know, and it could be one of those where Ireland have a slightly off day, and England turn up and have a great day or whatever. Or now that Scotland have broken their Cardiff hoodoo, maybe it's time for them to do the same in. Against the Irish. So you do never know, but certainly in terms of what we've seen on the opening weekend, I don't know, it's going to be hard to see any side matching Ireland, I think. And injuries and suspensions and whatever will happen, they've just got so much depth. They just constant conveyor belt of top quality talent to choose from. So yeah, I think they've got themselves in a brilliant position by winning that first one. And again, Farrell he knows how to get the most out of that set of players.
I managed to sort of miss the Italy England game, just sort of wandering around town in the rain. I saw snatches of it. It didn't look particularly
kind of unconvincing. I would say would be that. Interestingly, I think a lot can be said by Steve Borthwick's pre and post match reaction. Kind of before the game, the talk was, this is a really well-drilled set of players. And genuinely straight after the game was, we look like a set of players who haven't played together that much. So, I think a lot can kind of be read into that. And, I'm still undecided with this because they've got, again, a crop of really talented players, particularly the Northampton and Harlequins bunch, who play exciting rugby. Steve Borthwick has made some tinkering to his coaching team, which makes you think, again, there's going to be a degree of, a degree more enterprise out of them. But then I just don't know if that's in his nature. And kind of looking at the selection, I thought, well, the bold call is to go for Finn Smith from the get-go, isn't it? And go for him and have his, have Alex Mitchell inside him, who he knows from club rugby and has that shirt on merit. And I just thought perhaps that was a little bit of a conservative call, and maybe we're going to see more of that. Italy again had opportunities and gave them a little bit of a scare, but just couldn't quite stay in the game for long enough periods to kind of really challenge. So don't know, but I think it's kind of what you'd expect, because England have had a huge turnover of players, and Italy are under a new coach and they're at home. So I think it was kind of to be expected, unconvincing, but also if England then go on and have a blinder against Wales, all of that is forgotten very, very quickly. So I don't think they'll be dwelling too much on it, but you didn't necessarily see a huge amount out of it. Ethan Roots picked up man of the match. award, which is which is a big industrious performance. Again, some of the other players settled in well. I don't know. I just think, it will be one of those games that will be forgotten quite quickly, and the rest, how England go will depend on the other fixtures now, I think.
Yeah, it did seem a bit weird that the one game that you'd start your raw 10 at would be a test, obviously, but it would be a good test to have in when you've won 30 games on the bounce against a team,
I could understand as well if George Ford had been, because he's just coming back from injury and hasn't played particularly well for Sale and has looked like he's kind of finding his feet a bit. If he'd been in blistering form or, had carried on, on in the vein of some of those bigger World Cup performances.
Yeah, Chris Ashton was saying that he is the sort of player, there are certain players who just bounce straight back in, like Faletau tends to do. And then there are players who just need a bit of need time. And he's one of those players that he said that does need time to settle back into things. But, it's going to be, I don't know. It's going to be, who knows what's going to happen.
As I've said numerous times on this podcast, I hate these weeks. Like, I really do. Like, if we're playing the All Blacks, more than likely you're going to lose, because that's what's happened my entire lifetime. But there is an excitement about playing them always, even though it's going to be an incredibly tough encounter. Whereas with England, it's just like, I don't know. There's too much at stake. There is too much at stake. Whatever state both sides are in, playing England is just never. I can never enjoy the door. And even if we win, it's relief rather than joy, I think. I don't know. I find the game so... Yeah, no, that's true. But
2008 was not... That was the joy unconfined. I've never had a bit like that in my life. But,
I think so. I was there for 2012, which was my equivalent one of that. That was just, Scott Williams ripping the ball off Courtney Laws and then score. I was sat kind of directly looking at the ball as it bobbled up. As it bubbled up into Scott's hands, and that might be the best thing I've experienced in a stadium in my experience watching as a fan. You are right, but the build up's unbearable.
The same Paul that was threatened in the Llwyn Gwair Arms in Newport, Pembrokeshire, approached Leslie Vinicolo outside the stadium at about 7:30. And unlucky, Leslie, son, unlucky. And patting him on the back, who Leslie didn't look particularly amused after that.
I think the only thing that could have made that better is if he'd have called him Les. I think that would have been, as if he was a kind of flat cap wearing northerner rather than a hugely built man of Pacific origin.
We're jumping ahead. Are we going to talk?
No, let's do it. Let's talk England there. So I think for me, it is about what frame of mind these players go into it. Without trying to sound like Jake Humphries here, it is like if they go into it with a sense of belief and that kind of like fearlessness that they played the second half, and that's the thing that I think is going to be more important than the selection. They've just got to go there thinking, look, England will have watched that second half of Wales and thought, oh, bloody hell, actually, maybe there is something here. And you just want to, there is an opportunity to catch England cold because they're building. And it's a set of players who are unfamiliar with one another. So I really hope, again, it's almost like a bit of a, this is a shot to nothing. You've got a free hit here. Go out and play with the belief and the drive that you can go and do something special that will really get people on board. Again, I think it is that performance and the style and the manner of it that if they can do that and just keep us, get us believing again, it will do a huge amount for this side and we'll keep people on the side and we'll have the patience. We'll have the patience with that set of players.
Get them believing, that's the thing. You don't want to lose by 14 points to a lackluster England,
yeah,
who didn't actually turn up. If England turn up and they're they're excellent and they put us, they butcher us, then so be it. But that's the thing that I hate the most, is losing to a bad England side, not losing to a good one.
The counterpoint to my Scott Williams experience was, what would it have been, 5-6 years earlier in a World Cup warm-up game where they beat us, whatever it was, 63-5, and it was a scorching hot, and it was kind of their second string as well, and they completely put us to the sword, and it was a scorching hot day. The bar had even run out of beer, so we sat there drinking kind of stadium red wine in the blistering heat while getting absolutely mullered. Like every time they had the ball, they scored a try. And yeah, there's a few feelings as bad as that. You just want the ground to swallow you up at that point.
I didn't mind losing. I think it was the one after 2000, after 99. Mm. So it must have been 2000 in Cardiff, was it?
No, that
would have been a Twickenham. Yeah. So it was maybe 2001 then in Cardiff, I'm thinking. Mm. Did Will Greenwood score about 43 tries that day?
Seem to remember. Every bloody year in my
I can remember is Will Greenwood's blonde hair just like flopping over right under the post time and time again, like one of those kind of like an Adam Curtis thing, like it's just on repeat. And it didn't hurt then. That's the only time it's never hurt. Because of 99, I was armor plated, and I was like, whatever. We did you in the most ridiculous circumstances. But that never lasts, does it? So we're back in now. We're just kind of sitting here grimacing for the next 5 days, and just hoping that if they're great, fair enough. If they're not good, then we've got to just go for them, and we may not win, but as long as we give a good account of ourselves and don't butcher line, you know, any attacking line. Well, you know, you can butcher one. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll allow one butchered attacking lineup, but that's enough, you know?
Yeah. That was a question we had in actually from Daniel Former, which said, how can we fix the line? I mean, if I had a quid for every time we'd pondered that on here.
We've talked about it, we've been really generous, I think, and we've talked about the fact that it's systemic and you can't blame the two, and we're obviously always doing that with Dewi Lake because we want him to be the best hooker in the world, and we always just think, well, it's probably somebody else's fault because he's great. And the truth of the matter is, actually, when Elliot D came on, they were still doing the same thing, but we didn't make as many mistakes.
Is that enough to get him a start? Because it would be for me this time round. And I bet, you know, I'm not, there's no point.
And again, people were saying to me, oh, Elias. And I was going, do you remember him in Argentina where he was just, you know, he was heroic and we were up against it on tour and he was just amazing. And he was amazing in South Africa as well, wasn't he?
And during the World Cup as well, he made that position his own, even though his competition was, you know, was the co-captain. And he's put in some big performances. I just think that, yeah, it's so hard to know whose fault it is in these scenarios. But D came on, it made a positive difference. So for me, I just think you've got to reward that. I think
for me again, it's also to do with D's motivational abilities and the fact that he's not going to be scared, is he? You know, that's not what he does. And so he'll take the field and you'll get 100% out of him. And I'm not, yeah. How can you not reward somebody for a good performance? It would seem counterintuitive. I'm almost sure that we'll be scratching our heads a little bit. I don't know when the team announcement is.
I imagine it'll be Thursday.
Yeah. And we might be scratching our head and going, oh, really? Shouldn't, you know, one of these players, like they might not start with Lloyd or they might not start with Thomas. They might not start with D. You'd imagine that one of them might not make the starting lineup and we'll be a bit disappointed.
Yeah. And nine in particular as well is one that so often you see the guy with 21 on his back have a better game than the guy with nine, because the game has naturally broken up a bit more and you spend the first hour of the game box kicking, and after that things do change a little bit. So it could be that one. I hope with that, let's have a look at actually what you would do for the game against England. What changes would you like to see?
I'd probably like to see Will Rowlands come back in if he's training this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I get what you're saying about, I think Josh Adams has to be given another go, but I think there is a sort of beginning of it just feels, I don't know, if it feels like he's not quite as dynamic or as dangerous when he's cutting in. Or there was one point when he got the ball in the second half and you just thought, oh, that's it, he's got the energy back again. But that energy just hasn't been there a lot. But you just see this physical energy in players when you're, even if you're 80 yards away from them and you're on your fourth pint of pale ale, you know, you still see that kind of like dynamism, and you want to see that, like you said, maybe that's why he was thrown under the bus. But he's got to be, it's got to be, and Mason Grady on the wing against England is probably not a good,
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I would have been tempted to go with Grady for this weekend just on how he's been playing for Cardiff and the job he's been doing for them on the wing. He's looked really, really comfortable on the wing. And that, at the moment, I think is his best position. But yeah, I mean, I think for me, I'd stick with Winnett. I would probably stick with Adams because you know Grady's going to have an impact coming off the bench. And whether that's, you know, with 15 to go or with 30 to go, that's someone who will make a big impact. So I'd stick with Adams on the one wing, Dyer on the other. Tompkins, I think North comes back in.
Yeah.
I think that's a fairly easy swap. I would go Lloyd at 10 and I'd go Thomas at 10 and just say, right, this is a kind of a bit of a statement of how we're going to play this game. In the pack, not sure about Rowlands. You know, I mean, I think he's an awesome player. It just depends on match fitness. He's missed a couple of weeks now. But if they're, you know, if they're happy that he's fit, I'm more than happy for him to go in there. Back row, I'd start Alex Mann. I just thought the balance looked miles better when Alex Mann came on. And I know he's raw and he's played like 10 games of professional rugby or whatever it is, but I don't know. You know, if he's good enough to come off the bench, have that impact, make it score a try on his debut. And then, you know, he is just, he's a proper six, tackles hard, pain in the arse, niggly, looks like he likes a scrap as well. And then you've got him alongside Reffel and Wainwright. You know, that's a mean looking back row with plenty of balance in it.
And it's also notable to say with Mann that the back row didn't give any penalties away, did they, in the second half?
No. You know,
they didn't. There was a discipline there so the over-eagerness that we were talking about, or that kind of adrenaline and stuff, often that spills over into kind of, you know, props getting pinged for not releasing, but getting the hands on the ball or all sorts of different things. And that actually was, I thought that was quite heartening as well. It wasn't just the fact that we bossed the game, but we didn't actually commit any over eager defensive, even right at the end there, when there were like five, six, and they weren't, you know, Scotland weren't, they weren't mucking about. You know, they were grimly determined to get that try, and we didn't transgress then, which is
was
quite heartening, I think. So I would, that's one other reason. If your back row is not getting pinged very often, that's good as well.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, for me, I'd have him in there, and then tight head. This. Be a close call for me, I think, as to whether you stick with Leon or you bring Azzurati on. And Azzurati brought a lot off the bench, I thought. So yeah, that'd be another one to consider.
What did you make of the scrums? Because it didn't look like we were. I mean, we won a penalty where the Scots were going bonkers because they thought they'd done us. And
I think, looking at the whole squad that we've got available to us here, we're not expecting any dominant scrum performances. It's about whether you can get parity and on your own ball, get it in and out really quickly and do that efficiency bit. And so that's what's got to go well, because it will be a different challenge at Twickenham. Scotland have struggled for tight heads themselves. And yeah, I'm guessing England will probably go Marler and Stewart again. And, Marler's a brilliant scrummager still. So I think that's going to be interesting and challenging. But you just got to get your game right, haven't you? And as Gatland's always saying, there's a lot more breakdowns than there are scrums. So you've just got to execute your game. You've got to execute your game absolutely well. And he's picked a squad that is built for mobility rather than scrummaging. But that said, Azzurati, I think, he's the one in the squad who's got something to build on and become a scrummaging test tight head. So I don't know. I wouldn't have a problem if he came in for Leon, I don't think.
What do you think? Predictable, is there any point even predicting a scoreline,
Well, yeah. As, what did I predict last week? I predicted Wales 22, Scotland 20. Which at halftime I was looking spot on. Then I was like, all right, perfect. 22 points away, 22 unanswered points, and it wasn't a million miles from the truth. It was absurd. So God knows. I think it's the thing that's really difficult is after the first week, you do normally get a gauge for how settled sides are and what to expect for them. But I don't think either this Wales side or this England side has given you a true reflection of where they're at the moment. I would expect Wales to be a lot better from the get-go. I predict, head says England will win because they're at home and we haven't won there for a long time now. But heart says you play like that. And again, I think we just need those big performances. You need Wainwright to back it up and have another big one. And
it's been a
great
ask.
Form anyway.
But it's a big ask.
It's a big ask.
I think you need better players.
You do, but I think if you see him back it up, you go, oh Christ, hang on a minute. This has gone from being, oh, Aaron Wainwright's a really solid, dependable, excellent test match player to, oh shit, this is a guy in the form of his life. And then I think it just raises everyone else's confidence when you see someone playing at that level, rather than looking at the team sheet and going, oh, we've lost all our world-class players. Suddenly someone is stepping up to that mark. And I think him and Reffel and those players can do that. I think they've got it in them. So I think it's to see those players who performed well last week back it up with another big performance, I think will help. And you'll see the other players grow in stature off the back of it.
Well, there must be a cult of Wainwright thing going on in Brighton, because everyone who serves in coffee shops appears to have exactly the same hair and
what a look as well. It's such a brilliant throwback look.
To be in, I assume that he lives in the Newport area. He's certainly not. He doesn't live in Margate, which would be more suitable. So I think, hats off to him for that as well.
I love to think with him as well. It's not in some ironic way. I think he looks at the 80s and goes, yeah, that's great. I want to look like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Amazing. Just magnificent.
The close-ups on TV of his fringe was just like, oh, this is great. This is great. Because, on the Netflix documentary, let's not go there. That's interminable toss. Sorry. when the hairdresser he's got like one of those Walker's lights on his forehead, and he's cutting Ellis Genge's hair in his bedroom before the match, and you just think, that's fine. Yeah, you do that. You have like a 200 quid haircut from a bloke who looks like an unemployed miner. But I'll have Wainwright's hair any day of the week.
Yeah, I will. Nothing bad about him. And let's hope this time next week we're sat here reviewing a performance that looked like the second half rather than the first half. Because Jesus, if we thought it would have been bad getting a hammer into Scotland, imagine that to England. So let's just think optimistic. I know Murph. We spoke to Murph on the WhatsApp group, and he wasn't buying it. So no. I hope that this is the moment where we can back it up with a big performance. And just it's something to believe in, isn't it? That's all we want.
Yeah, and they've given us some reason to believe in it, haven't they? So fair play to him for doing that. Fair play to him.
We're in that rare moment where both of us are being optimistic. So we better call it a night there. So a big thank you to Justin for joining us. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thanks as always to our sponsors at So Coffee. If you want to get some coffee in for the rest of the Six Nations, you can do that at socoffeetrades.co.uk. And if you go onto our Twitter page and go via the link on there, there's a discount code as well. So yeah, get yourself a little offer while we're on there. And we will be back to talk rugby with you very, very soon. Thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.